Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hey everyone, this is The Takeaway. I'm Kai Wright, host of WNYC's The United States of Anxiety, in for Tanzina Vega, who is back later this week.
We have to get this right. Details matter, because we have to continue to build confidence in the American people that their government can function for them and deliver.
Last week, President Joe Biden signed his $1.9 trillion economic relief package into law. In addition to enhanced unemployment insurance and one-time payments of $1,400, the American Rescue Plan also makes some changes to tax policies that could go a long way for some families. One of those changes is an expansion of the child tax credit. Combined with a number of other measures, the bill could target child poverty in the most substantial way in modern history, at a time when so many parents are struggling financially.
It's the New Deal. It's FDR. When he said Social Security, we lift 90% of seniors out of poverty. We are going to lift millions of children and their families out of poverty with the stroke of the pen.
That's Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, who's been advocating for the expansion of the child tax credit since 2003. More than a year into the pandemic, almost 8 million people have fallen into poverty, and 2.3 million women have left the workforce while taking on additional responsibilities at home. And so we start The Takeaway this week with a look at what the expanded child tax credit could mean for the future of child poverty. With me now are Chabeli Carazana, economy reporter for the 19th, and Fatima Goss Graves, president of the National Women's Law Center. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Glad to be here.
So, Chabeli, let's start with you. What exactly is included in the expansion of the child tax credit?
Yeah, so there's three big changes that come about from this expansion, right? So right now, families get about $2,000 from the child tax credit every year in their taxes, right? So the three big things that are going to happen now is that that amount is going to increase quite substantially. So it's going to be about $3,000 for children ages 6 to 17, and $3,600 for younger children under the age of 6. The other thing that's going to happen is that instead of an annual payment, you're going to be getting, families are going to be getting these payments periodically. So it could be monthly, it could be every few months. The IRS, I think, is still trying to figure out exactly what that time frame is, but it's going to be coming more frequently in parts, right? And then, of course, the most substantial part of this change is that it's going to be fully refundable. So what that means is that the poorest families in the country, the ones that, you know, have no tax liability and previously would not have been able to access the full amount, are now going to get the full amount. And so what that does is it's going to make it accessible for 27 million children, including about half of all Black and Latinx kids. And it's going to raise about 10 million kids to or above the poverty line.
So those are all some of the significant changes that are going to happen. One of those that pops out at me is that second one, this business about you're going to get the payments monthly. That seems like an important difference in managing your budget.
That's a big one, especially for low-wage families, right? You don't want to wait until the next year when you file your taxes to be getting this money. You're instead going to get it several hundred dollars a month or periodically. And so the idea there is to really aid those families that are really struggling, who might be essential workers, who might have lost their jobs throughout this pandemic. A lot of those folks are women. And so to be able to get those funds quicker, and that will help you, give you a little cushion, right? Maybe, you know, finish out the rent or pay some other needs.
Right. Fatima, can you try to put this piece of the package in the larger perspective for the COVID relief package? How significant is this piece of it?
Well, You know, this piece would frankly be significant on its own, but when paired with other important things, including the extension of unemployment insurance changes, which reach additional categories of workers, the deepening of child care assistance. We've lost 1 in 6 child care providers during this pandemic, and major investments in things like housing and food. It is our hope that we are finally doing, a year into the pandemic, the types of things to hurt those who have struggled the most this last year.
So to help those who have struggled the most. So let's think about that particular group. That, you know, it's particularly meaningful, as Chabeli pointed out, to families in the lowest income brackets, people who aren't making any money or not enough money to owe taxes in the first place. So what exactly has changed for those families, Fatima, in the course of this package? What are they going to get? And what are they now guaranteed as a consequence of this?
Right. Well, if you think about what has happened in this last year, you mentioned essential workers. There are many people who have been working on the front lines of this pandemic, but not with regular wages and not with family sustaining wages. There are others, many millions, who have had to leave the workforce, with childcare being a big part of it, but also things like the fact that they were working in sectors that have shut down in this period. And we're not talking about folks who were sort of sitting on some nest egg or cushion to get them through an unexpected pandemic. And so people have gone deep into debt. People have not been able to make it work. And so when I think about the types of things that we had in place before, we didn't have systems to capture people for the length of time of this pandemic. We didn't have the sorts of housing assistance to have people feel secure right now. And so there's a real worry about increasing homelessness in this period as well.
Chabeli, we know that Black and Latinx children are living disproportionately in poverty, in high levels of poverty compared to their white counterparts. What has your reporting shown that this expansion will mean for those families from a sort of racial justice perspective?
Yeah, it's going to have a really disproportionate impact on these groups because, again, they've been suffering more than the other groups. So, you know, when we're looking at, you know, some estimates for the child poverty rate for Black children, right, we're looking at a potential drop of from 17.8% to 9.7%, right? For Latinx kids, that could be a drop from 21.7% to 13.4%. So it's a really substantial measure, particularly when you look at children of color, because their families and their parents are most likely to be the ones working in the sectors that lost jobs this year, right? We saw, you know, I cover women and LGBTQ folks and Black women and Latinx and Latinas. They had the highest unemployment rates of any group this year, right? Latinas were up at 20% at one point this year, and Black women were over 16.5%. So they were the ones, they're most likely to be heads of households, right? So if they're losing their jobs, their children are suffering as a result of all of that. And so these are the groups that were hurt the most this year and could see the biggest, that had the most to gain from an expansion like this that would help, again, the lowest wage families that before this year could not access this full credit.
It's interesting. I mean, those numbers that you give, I don't know how many people appreciate what child poverty is in the United States in the first place, sort of compared to other developed nations. Can you talk about that a little, Chabeli? How do we measure up?
You know, the United States, you know, for everything else it does, is really behind on child poverty when, you know, compare it to other OECDs, other developed countries, right? And so there's really only a few countries that have a higher child poverty rate than us: Turkey, Mexico, but there's not much else on the other end of the spectrum. It's like us and then just a few others. Doing better than us: Germany, Japan, Australia, France, Switzerland, Denmark, the UK had a similar child tax credit program. They had a few other parts of that initiative, but they were able to cut child poverty in half with a similar measure. Canada has a child allowance. And so, you know, when we look at the countries that we would consider similar to us, right, we're the only ones that are missing this piece. And so it would bring us up to par, I think, with some of our counterparts.
Fatima, can you help us think about that in the broader context, sort of beyond the bill itself? That, you know, we know that research shows that the cycle of poverty is hard to interrupt once you found yourself living through it. We have these child poverty numbers that Chabelli is spelling out. And we know that the pandemic is making it harder. So, you know, when we have something like the American Rescue Plan that could cut child poverty by half, we hear that stark, that startling statistic. What can that mean in a broader context for a generation of kids?
Well, you know, I hope we actually learn a lesson, because the thing that I wanted to name is that in a year, these expansions will expire. But so I hope what we will learn is a very basic lesson, is that it works to support families in poverty, that it works to do things like make a credit available to them, a payment available to them over time, rather than forcing families to wait until tax time, and that it works to support families whose wages are so low that they aren't going to get a big tax refund at the end of the year. The shift in making this credit refundable so that even the lowest income families, even those who are in deep poverty, are able to benefit from it. That is the sort of shift that we should have been thinking about a long time ago. And when we pair the child tax credit with some of the other reforms that we have, it is my hope that we learn a lesson of what it looks like to support our families who are in the most pain in this sort of period, that is good for families, that will be good for children over time. So we're going to be monitoring this a lot and really telling the story of families who have been able to have this important intervention.
Other types of welfare programs restrict how money can be spent. What about that? Are there strings attached in this case, Fatima? How are these funds more flexible?
No, I mean, this is really a part of making our tax code fairer, right, is another way to think about it. In general, if you think about the ways that our tax code works at its sort of foundations, it builds in this inequality where it gives lots of additional benefits to those who are at the top of the income bracket and to those who are businesses. But for families, especially those with low incomes, our tax code hasn't typically been shifted around them. So these are dollars that families will have to spend in this period as they need.
I kind of hear you saying that we shouldn't even be thinking about it as a, quote, welfare program, but rather as a fair tax program.
Way to think about it. It is a part of making our tax code fair.
So Fatima, Representative Rosa DeLauro has been introducing this idea of an expanded child tax credit since 2003. Why has it taken this long to get it done?
You know, what we have been missing in this period, frankly, is the political will to get it done. We've been missing the idea that we should focus on families in poverty, families in deep poverty as well. But we also, I believe, have been battling public narratives that painted people who make low incomes as if they were the problem, rather than the fact that they were in jobs that were paying low incomes, that they were in jobs that didn't allow them to have regular and steady schedules and raises and salaries that allowed them to support their families. I think the pandemic provided a real window into what happens when even more people go into poverty, and the acceleration we needed to finally get this done.
Yeah. Chabelli, what about that? Is there a change in the political conversation here in this bill, as Fatima suggests, is there a shift here in how Washington thinks and talks about dealing with poverty?
Yeah, you know, I think there is. And I spoke to Representative DeLauro about her long history with this. This past week, it was 18 years to the day when she first introduced the idea of a fully refundable child tax credit. And she talks about, you know, back then I was oftentimes the only voice talking about this. There wasn't really anybody to have the conversation with. Nobody entertained it, right? And so now we're at a time where in the past few years in particular, not just this year, where we're starting to see more, particularly Republicans, come out with versions of a child tax credit expansion. Now, this is a conversation that wasn't happening, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. Marco Rubio, Mike Lee, Mitt Romney, they have all come out in support of an expansion to some, of some sort. And so the conversation has really shifted where there are a lot of people who are interested in finding some kind of solution.
What about the Republicans who don't support it? What's the argument against it?
Well, again, it's welfare assistance, right? There's that concern, and that has come up a lot. You know, even Rubio and Lee, who have come out in support of the child tax credit, you know, are worried that it's welfare assistance for families and it should not be given to, if you don't have a tax liability, essentially if you're not paying anything in taxes every year, you shouldn't be getting access to this credit. And so that's kind of the tension point, right? And then honestly, it's expensive. It's expensive to expand the child tax credit. And so, you know, Fatima was talking about it a little bit earlier, this expansion that we have right now is for a year. In less than a year, we're going to be talking about this again to see if it's going to become permanent, what shape that will take. And that's going to be a tough conversation about how do we fund this in the long term.
Well, quite notably, that's going to be going into a midterm election as well, a congressional election. There is some thought that the Democrats set that up as sort of a political strategy.
Well, there's no doubt that that is going to be part of the conversation at that point. And look, the reality is these checks are going to be very, very visible, right? Families are going to be getting them every so often, every few weeks. The stimulus checks from this past year were overwhelmingly popular. And so this is sort of a similar idea where you're going to be getting that tangible money, right? And so it's going to be really popular and Democrats are banking on that. How are you going to tell your constituents in a year, we're going to take this away now? So that is a pro for the Democrats that want to expand this. It's just a question of when we look at a permanent expansion over a long period of time, where does that money come from? It's trillions of dollars. We have to sort of find a way to fund that.
Fatima, we've said that 2.3 million women have left the workplace since the start of the pandemic. Can you help us think about what, for those women in particular, what this would mean from a gender perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking all the time about the women, especially women of color, who have just borne the brunt of this pandemic. And it is my hope that the combination between the certainty of the credit and the unemployment insurance extensions give them a little hope and relief in this period. People were asked to do the impossible of work basically as essential workers and care for children without a care infrastructure. We knew that that wasn't going to be a thing that was sustainable, and it's not. And so I hope it helps get people through. I hope it gets people some hope, and that it reminds us that the people who are most important in our lives can be supported.
How are you each feeling now as we hopefully stare towards the end of this period of the pandemic, at least? Vaccines are coming. There's a new administration. We have this bill that is being discussed. Both of you are talking about it as such a remarkable sea change. I just kind of want to take your temperature on what the next couple of years you think will look like in this realm. Let's start with you, Jabeli.
Yeah, you know, it's been a really hard year. And, you know, like I said, I really focus on women, LGBTQ folks, and those groups have been hit so, so hard. It does feel, you know, as we got to the end of this relief package, it's a massive $1.9 trillion. There's multiple components in there that, you know, a lot of that is going to help these folks. And I'm just thinking about the child tax credit. I was looking at some statistics about who it would help the most, right? You know, like 47% of medical assistants would benefit, right? That's like 94% women. 38% of childcare workers would benefit. That's 95% women. So it's like a lot of this aid that's coming is really targeted for the people who have endured unimaginable financial duress this year, apart from the health outcomes, of course. And so it does feel like with the vaccines rollout beginning and with this money coming in, that we might be turning a corner.
What about you, Fatima?
You know, I think about over the last year and story after story of dramatically long food lines was in the news, and story about in a single month, over 800,000 women leaving the workforce. And we still weren't acting with the urgency to actually support and hold people in this country through a 100-year pandemic. We hadn't had anything like this in a century. And we came through. The political will, the strength, to actually do what families need to be able to relieve the pain they have been feeling. It is heartening. It is exciting. And the thing is, I'm not saying we're done. This isn't about the long-term recovery. This really is about supporting families who are struggling in this period. And I am really glad that it happened.
Fatima Gosgraves is the president of the National Women's Law Center. Jabeli Karazana is the economy reporter for the 19th. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Paul from Portland. I fully support the child tax credit, but it won't benefit me whatsoever, and I imagine quite a few others who haven't been able to start families because of the prohibitive cost of housing and medical care. Still, I hope it helps those that are able to have kids.
Well, the stimulus check doesn't mean that much to me because I owe more than that in my current tax return to the IRS.
What will the stimulus money mean to me? Our house is falling down around us, and now we will be able to make some critical repairs.
This is Mike from Germantown. It may actually put us in an awkward spot because our health care comes through the state, and the extra income might actually put us in a bracket where we have to buy our insurance on the private market. And because we have disabilities in our family, that might actually wind up costing us more than it helps us. I have a coworker that's got two kids with his current wife and two other kids from a previous marriage that he pays child support for. And all of his PUA has gone to pay the child support. So he's had to work through the whole pandemic, going into people's houses with, you know, two surgical masks on in order to keep his family fed. There's a lot of people who are told they do not qualify for benefits like food stamps or Medicare. And there's a lot more who see the federal government's help on one hand that kind of like screws them over because, like, here's your PUA. And then they tell you, oh, look, you made too much money. So now your food stamps and your student loan deferments and your health care, you know, go away. And good luck with that.
Want to be a part of the takeaway? Record your take as a voice memo on your phone. Email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com and make your voice heard. Or call us at 877-869-8253.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What is it about Dana-Farber that makes it such a powerful adversary against cancer? It's hundreds of Dana-Farber researchers and clinicians making new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber discoverers. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, nothing is as effective against cancer as a relentless succession of breakthroughs. Go to danafarber.org/everywhere and see how what we do here changes lives everywhere.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Kai Wright from WNYC in for Tanzina. This is The Takeaway. The city of Jackson, Mississippi is weeks into a water crisis brought on by the same winter storms that rocked Texas last month. While water is now returning to some homes and businesses, others still don't have running water. A water boil order remains in place for the city's 160,000 residents, 80% of whom are Black. This isn't the first water crisis to hit Jackson, and it's one that's been years in the making, as the city's infrastructure has suffered decades of neglect and underinvestment from the state and from the federal government. For more on this, we're joined by Donna Ladd, who is editor of the Mississippi Free Press and the Jackson Free Press. Donna, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, first off, Donna, how much of Jackson has been affected by this current water crisis?
Well, all of Jackson has been affected in one way or another. I never lost water access, but we've been boiling water since February 16th. Wow. So no fresh water. But, you know, early on, tens of thousands, you know, of people just didn't have water access at all. And some of them still don't because of the water pressure issues.
And when you say you've been boiling water since February 16th, help people understand what you mean by that, just sort of in a day-to-day kind of way. What does that mean for your life?
Well, it means that you have to think about everything you're doing that involves water. You know, it's like you can't have ice. You can't drink water without boiling it. You know, I boil water three times in a kettle before having a cup of tea, and I'm a lot better off than many people in the city. But that's been my reality for the past month. It also means buying a lot of water if you can afford it.
And have certain parts of the city been affected more than others? I'm thinking particularly about race and income here. Is everybody feeling it the same regardless of that, or are one part hit more than others?
Well, overall, the whole city was hit. So even at least from the boil water parts of it, you know, the lack of access to safe water initially. But, you know, things come back online quicker for the white neighborhoods. And mm-hmm. South Jackson and West Jackson have been really hit the hardest. And those are majority Black neighborhoods, communities that have been in many ways devastated by white flight and disinvestment over the years already. Those are the neighborhoods that are really getting hit, that did not have potable water, didn't have any water, and some still don't. Those are majority Black, certainly.
And when you say South and West Jackson, what, is that a geographic issue? Why are those two areas hit the hardest?
Some of it is technical in the sense of, as I understand it, where the water treatment plants are located, issues like elevation, mm-hmm. right? Now, you could spend some time tracing all of those things backward to where the water treatment plants are located, which are more on, you know, the wider side of Jackson and, right. you know, into the edge of the wider suburbs. And so, yeah, so it's technical, but it's also, what's very important to say is that it's disinvestment, and it's the state and the federal government kind of pulling back support of cities like Jackson so that we haven't been able to afford the repairs that are needed to the system to keep things upgraded. So ultimately, it's about, you know, an 80% majority Black city these days that suffers because of racism and the unwillingness of state leaders to work with Jackson to solve these issues. And then also, you know, as we're discovering, as we look deeper into it, historic disinvestment from the federal government.
There was a ton of national media coverage in the aftermath of what happened in Texas. The same things were happening there in Mississippi. Why do you think the situation there hasn't gotten the same level of attention?
Well, that's typical for Mississippi. I think it's a complicated answer. A lot of it has to do with, I think, the national psychology of seeing Mississippi as this terrible place that gets what it deserves. And I think that's kind of a bipartisan bias that also infiltrates a lot of the media. One of our leaders says or does something terrible, and Twitter fills up with statements about how, you know, just pull all help from the state of Mississippi because we're such a terrible place. And, you know, and I think that's rooted in our history as being the most outwardly, obviously racist state with the most race violence. Sure, but that doesn't mean that we're not the state with the highest proportion of African Americans in the nation, 38%, and a lot of good people here working harder than I've ever seen anywhere every single day to try to change things.
It sounds like you're saying that it's not just that these stereotypes sort of affect the cultural conversation about Mississippi, but it actually directly impacts the kind of resources that are sent there.
Oh, it absolutely does. If there's anything Mississippians can agree on across divides is, you know, how we get talked about. Now, a lot of it's deserved. This issue needs to be talked about nationally, and the racism that keeps the state trying to control the city and giving it very few resources and or taking its resources away, such as the airport. You know, all of those things need to be part of the national conversation. But at the same time, those things don't often break through because people roll their eyes at Mississippi. And, you know, we're seen as such a quote unquote red state, language I hate, by the way. Mm-hmm. And then we don't get, you know, we don't get considered for the kinds of resources that we actually need. We are known as a taker state because we get a lot of, we do get a lot of federal resources, but it's not an intelligent national conversation that really looks at Mississippi. And Mississippi is the microcosm of what's going on in the whole nation. Mm-hmm. And in cities across America. And if you can't look at your arguably poorest state, poverty-wise and health-wise, where, you know, our leaders won't, you know, they resist Medicaid expansion and other solutions. You know, if you can't look at that state and say what's going on there is a national crisis that we all need to look at our role in and what we can do about it, then I don't think you're real serious about helping poor people in America.
What about infrastructure in Jackson? And before we have to let you go, what does this tell us about what is needed, what investments are needed right now in Jackson?
You know, Mayor Lumumba likes to say that there's at least $2 billion needed for our water and sewer infrastructure, and maybe more than that ultimately. You know, the state can't afford everything we need, especially after being so irresponsible in letting this drag out for so long. What we are figuring out that is really needed is for the state, the city, and the federal government to come together and be at the same table and really look at what can happen long term. Sure, the state right now needs to help staunch the bleeding, but that conversation needs to happen right now about what can be done, not just for Jackson, but to help kind of rebuild infrastructure, this basic infrastructure that's about human life, and to how to get past this racism and bigotry toward our cities and toward a state like Mississippi.
Donna Ladd is the editor of the Mississippi Free Press and the Jackson Free Press. Donna, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kai.
This morning, the Oscar nominations were announced, and some of them were particularly notable. The late, great Chadwick Boseman was nominated for Best Actor for his final performance in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Nomadland director Chloe Zhao became the first Asian woman, and first woman of color, period, if you can believe that, ever to be nominated for Best Director. And Promising Young Woman's Emerald Fennell was also nominated for Best Director, making this the first time that two women will ever compete in the same year in that category. Also, the movie Minari, directed by Lee Isaac Chung, received a bevy of nominations, including for Best Picture, Best Screenplay, and Best Director. It's a long list. The film follows a Korean family who moved from California to Arkansas, where the father, played by Steven Yeun, struggles to fulfill his dream of starting a farm. Yeun and Yoo Jung, who plays his character's mother-in-law, were both nominated for their performances as well, but their nominations stand in contrast to a long history of Asian and Asian American actors getting overlooked for awards in the U.S., even when the films they star in get recognition in more technical categories. Shirley Lee is a staff writer covering culture for The Atlantic, and she explored this trend in a recent piece. Shirley, thanks for being here.
Hi, Kai. Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Charles Yu, author of Interior Chinatown and a television writer for shows including Westworld and Legion. Charles, great to have you as well.
Thank you, Kai. Great to be here.
So Shirley, before we get into some of the bigger issues you raised in your piece, let's talk about these nominations Minari received this morning. Did any of them come as a surprise to you?
No, I'm just thrilled that Steven Yeun and Yun Yuzhen have been nominated. I think those two were the front runners out of the cast. I was a little disappointed that Yeri Han didn't get anything, but I'm just thrilled.
All right. And you mentioned Yeri Han. She plays the mother Monica in Minari. You've written that she hasn't gotten as much recognition as some other co-stars. Why do you think that is?
Well, I'm going to toss this one over to the writer-director, Lee Isaac Chung, who I interviewed for this piece. He talked about her performance being relatively invisible. And I think part of the invisibility comes from the way that her character is so nuanced and doesn't quite fit into a prescribed box or a trope that Hollywood tends to prefer when rewarding, even rarely, Asian actors and Asian performances. She plays the mother of the family, and she is playing a relatively quiet role, but she's also the kind of character who is trying very hard not to express her hurt and her anxiety and her pain. And often when we talk about these award-winning roles or award-worthy performances, we think about those outsized dramatic performances, right? And she's very careful not to show any emotion. Mm-hmm. And yet her performance is all about that anxiety. It is humming with it. And so it is a really raw, real performance, but it is hard to understand.
She kind of stole the show for me, I'll be honest. Charles, what about those boxes that Shirley's talking about? Hollywood likes to put people in these boxes that they can understand. Do you think any of the Minari characters fit neatly into this sort of boxes that non-Asian viewers like to put people in?
Yeah, okay. I thought Shirley's piece really nailed it for me on a number of points, and that was really such an insight for me, what she said about, you know, it's almost like her performance is designed to be overlooked. That is the point of it. And she's not doing things that are flashy. But for me, watching her and watching Steven Yeun's performance, they both, it was almost like they had an emotional vocabulary that I understood intuitively, you know, just watching it. And maybe it takes, you know, sort of people time to realize when you're watching a performance like this, or the performer as an individual, to sort of learn that vocabulary, not in that didactic sense, but in the sense of, oh, this is what this person is embodying, you know. So I know a certain pattern of gestures, or I know, you know, what acting is, you know, looks like, but this is, you know, something else that's going on here. Still acting, of course, but you know, maybe a style or with moves that we haven't necessarily seen before.
What about Yoo Jung-yoon? What do you guys think about her performance? What do you think stood out for her?
Oh, I absolutely. Shirley. Yeah, I absolutely adored her performance. For her, I also spoke with her for the piece. She, you know, she is considered one of the greatest actors in South Korea. And so for her, even speaking of American awards, she didn't really know what they meant. But her performance also comes from a deeply personal space. She told me that she had thought about her own interactions with her great-grandmother in order to live inside her character's head. You know, her grandmother is not the typical American grandmother, which is what the little boy in the film thinks that his grandmother is going to be. She's witty. She's acerbic. You know, she doesn't punish him for the pranks he pulls. She's always encouraging him to, you know, to run, to do things that he's been told that he cannot do. And there's this humanity to her performance that also comes, as I said, from her own history, from her own experiences. And often, I touch on this in the piece, often these performances get confused for recordings when they are still performances in and of themselves. So for me, her performance stood out because you could easily see her as the comic relief of the film. You know, she is funny. her character is funny. And Yujin was telling me that after screenings, people would tell her, "You're so funny." But there's a heart and a humanity to this role that goes deeper than just saying some funny lines. It's just easy to call her funny.
And Charles, let's talk for a second about the Golden Globes, because they have gotten a lot of criticism the past 2 years for nominating Minari and then the Farewell, both in the Best Foreign Language Film category, although both films were made by Asian American directors. What do you think that tells us about how films made by Asian Americans are viewed by people who are not Asian?
Well, it's a good question, Kai. On the one hand, it has sort of a perpetuating effect to continue this idea of, you know, here are stories that are interesting, but they belong in this category. They don't belong in sort of the mainstream category. On the other hand, you know, I think it's worth noting that we're talking about it, you know, and it was a controversy for a reason, which I think is that people recognized that this is an issue. I think it's also worth noting that there's been a lot of progress. I mean, the film Minari got made, you know, with Plan B and A24. You know, it's not as if the doors were completely closed. It got all the way to the point where people could have a controversy. So not to sort of settle for anything, but I think it's, you know, an ongoing conversation, which gives me some hope.
Right. Shirley, in your article about Asian American actors being overlooked, you have a long list of films that were nominated for Oscars in certain categories, but not for acting. What are some of the most notable examples to you?
Oh man, there are so many. you know, you have, just looking at Best Picture winners in the past, Slumdog Millionaire, The Last Emperor, which is about The Last Emperor of China. These were films that were nominated across the board for many, many categories, but none for acting. Last year's Parasite fits in this category, Life of Pi, Memoirs of a Geisha. And I think I wrote this piece because when I had talked to another film, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, when I talked to the actor Michelle Yeoh, she was telling me that it did hurt, you know, for her acting and her peers acting, you know, in the film not to be considered, even though the movie was nominated and up for all these other things, including Best Picture and Best Director. There are many, many films that fall under this category. And, you know, Charles makes a great point. There is, you know, there's reason for hope, but it is unfortunate to be in this place where every quote-unquote win or step forward for the community, it also comes with a certain feeling of a bummer, I think, as Steven Yeun had put it a while back. Just this feeling that, oh, it took this long. That's the unfortunate side of all this.
Yeah. You've also written that you feel like when Asian actors are nominated, it's when they've got a white savior character alongside them. What do you mean by that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this goes into what one of the academics I spoke to called the, quote, veneer of authenticity that's placed on films about Asian characters. There's a tendency to see them fitting in certain tropes and only rewarding them when they act out certain tropes, which is something that I believe, you know, Charles's book goes into as well. So when I write about this, I'm looking at the way that some Asian performers, when they've been nominated for Oscars in the past, they've only been nominated for fitting inside these boxes that we've been talking about. So for instance, Dev Patel, he wasn't nominated for Slumdog Millionaire, where he plays the hero. The film also has a lot of Bollywood influences. He's not nominated for that performance. However, he's nominated for playing an Australian Indian adoptee in the film Lion, which, you know, some critics saw as a white savior tale, as you said. He's not the hero here. He's the one who's being saved by a white family.
Yeah. Charles, Shirley mentioned your book, Interior Chinatown, where you talk about some of this pigeonholing. And you feel like there's been some progress, you were saying before the break. Has there been progress in sort of moving away from these kinds of roles in recent years, you think?
I think there's been some. I mean, I think we're already seeing it, and it's exciting to see Asians and Asian Americans both, you know, behind and in front of the camera, not just stuck in sort of what were traditionally you know, the few roles that were allowed for Asians on screen. I think we're somewhere between, like, if the door was closed before, and you know, for like a white star, it'd be like the door's open and here's your chair. You know, we're somewhere like the door's open, but bring your own chair. You know, like, we're not going to seat you, but come on in.
Maybe we got a better chair anyway. What do you think about these awards in general, Charles? I mean, does this matter? Shirley was saying that she talked to Michelle Yeoh from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. She felt like she was hurt by not being nominated. What do you think? Do these words really matter?
I think they do. I mean, I think they certainly matter to the individuals, and that's important to remember, that for each, you know, performance, it's not in a vacuum, as Shirley was pointing out, and there are cultural and other sort of factors going into it. But I think they also matter, you know, to people watching, you know, both Asian American or non-Asian American, in terms of a sort of level of acceptance or a validation. So to me, they matter a great deal. Sorry, I don't know if that was for Shirley or for me, but
it was for you. But Shirley, you can answer too. What do you think?
No, I agree. I think it's really easy to look down on awards and say, oh, they're, you know, the categorization, there are controversies everywhere, but on an individual level, they do matter. And for the average theater goer or movie goer, I think they, you know, I mean, marketing tends to use nominations and awards as part of a movie's appeal. And I think this just means a greater reach for films like Minari.
Right. We got about a minute left. Thinking about representation in this moment, you know, it is a time when we're talking about violence against Asian Americans spiking. How do you think these kinds of portrayals matter to the broader culture in that way? Let's start with you, Charles.
Yeah, I mean, I think they really help to normalize, you know, Asian faces on screen, you know, in stories that have to do with a whole range of things, not just sort of cultural heritage stories. So I think they go a long way to, you know, sort of getting into people's psyches that these are American stories.
Right. Shirley, in 10 seconds, what do you think?
Oh, I agree. I think the real world and Hollywood, you can't really separate them on this level. Stereotypes that are perpetuated on screen are perpetuated in real life. And so to be able to see these stories normalized, as Charles said, it's important.
Shirley Lee is a staff writer covering culture for The Atlantic, and Charles Yu is the author of Interior Chinatown and a television writer for shows including Westworld and Legion. Great talking to both of you.
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, everybody, that's it for us today on The Takeaway. I'm with you most of the week, and then Tanzina is back with you. If you want to keep up with me on Twitter, I'm at Kai_Wright. And you can also hear me on WNYC's The United States of Anxiety. Subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, or join us live on Sunday evenings. You check us out at wnyc.org/anxiety. Also, if you missed anything or want to listen back again, check out The Takeaways podcast at thetakeaway.org or anywhere you get audio. And of course, talk to us about anything. You can hit the Contact Us tab at thetakeaway.org and record your message. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Kai Wright, and this is The Takeaway. Back at it tomorrow.